From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. For well over two decades now, no one has been able to defeat Louise Slaughter in her bids for re-election to Congress. The Democrat now represents the reshaped 25th District, and in her last race, she handily defeated Monroe County Executive Maggie Brooks. This year, she faces Gatestown Supervisor Mark Cassini, and he believes he has the formula to finally defeat Congresswoman Slaughter. Mark Cassini is with us in studio for the hour. It's part of our ongoing effort to bring candidates for prominent offices to Connections, and to you, your opportunity to speak directly to them, and we welcome Mark Cassini. Thanks for being here. Nice to see you.
Evan, thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation.
Before we talk to Mr. Cassini, a bit of breaking news on this Wednesday. The poet Maya Angelou has passed away, and in the next hour, my colleague Michelle Faust will talk to a local professor about Angelou's legacy. But first, here is Maya Angelou herself, in her own words, speaking to WXXI News about how women need courage, especially women involved in abusive relationships.
Well, I feel sorry for women who are so afraid of being alone. They allow themselves to be isolated from their families. And, of course, they are really alone. And sometimes their husband or the man in their lives are very unkind and even brutal. But they hold on out of fear. Some feel, well, I have no place to go. He makes all the money. I just heard a man say, I'd rather be living in a cardboard box under a bridge than with somebody who brutalizes me all the time. One of the things I feel really embarrassed for them, because I know they're embarrassed when the man embarrasses them in public or speaks rudely to them in public. I wish women would develop courage. It is the most important of all the virtues. Because without courage, you can't practice any other virtue consistently. And you don't have to be bodacious about it. Just quiet courage.
That's Maya Angelou speaking about women in abusive relationships. Maya Angelou passing away today at the age of 86. We're going to hear more about her legacy in our next hour on Connections. And I think maybe that's some of her words there about women in abusive relationships. There is a poignant place to start there. A lot of the news coverage in the last 5 days or so has been about the Isla Vista massacre. And so I want to start the conversation with Mark Cassini, again, the Republican challenging Congresswoman Louise Slaughter this year in the 25th Congressional District. A lot of comments about what we're seeing there in Isla Vista, Mark. It's one incident. We saw six people killed, and then the seventh, the killer shot himself, a young man who was targeting women. He was angry about women. He was angry about what he thought was his denial of his whatever sort of skewed rightful ownership he had about sort of strange views about women. And the death of not only several women but several young men there sparked one of the parents to rail about gun control, the NRA, and Congress. And so I'd like to listen to the words of Richard Martinez. His son is Christopher Martinez. He was killed in Isla Vista in the massacre last weekend. This is Richard Martinez in an emotional plea about guns. It's the first cut there, Dave, if you see it there. Right there. So this is Richard Martinez, the parent, talking about his son being killed.
Chris died because of craven, irresponsible politicians and the NRA. They talk about gun rights. What about Chris's right to live? When will this insanity stop? When will enough people say, stop this madness? We don't have to live like this. Too many have died. We should say to ourselves, not one more.
That's Richard Martinez. First of all, Mark Cassini is here, and he is a father, a grandfather. You understand the emotion. Regardless if you agree with the comments, you understand the emotion.
It's difficult to listen to. It's heartbreaking. It truly is. You can hear the pain in his voice and the hopelessness from losing a loved one. It's so sad. But I think we need to have a dialogue in this country, and it's always easy to vilify an object, a gun or a knife or a car. But the truth is that the gun, knife, and car were not the root cause of this issue. And too many of the issues that we've been reading about and seeing on TV over the last few years were tied to mental illness. And we have to start talking with our mental health professionals to try to detect and address these issues in school, specifically as early as the, you know, first, second, third grade, and we're dealing with in this state, for instance, a number of mental health facilities that have closed, and those individuals have been put back out in the street without the care and help they need. So we really need to have a serious discussion on how to deal with mental illness in this state and in this nation, and that's really where the dialogue should start.
The challenge seems to be that certainly he had mental health issues that were clear, but it is very difficult to understand when someone is going to cross over and become violent. And the mental health community will have a great challenge in deciding who should be treated, who should be released, who should be incarcerated because of a threat of violence. And incarcerating someone before they commit violence is always a challenge, isn't it?
Right. We're dealing with a balance. We certainly in this country honor our rights as citizens, our freedoms. And when you're dealing with mental illness, there are times when potentially those rights may be brought into question when you have to treat somebody and do a mental hygiene arrest and deal with them in that way. But we need to have that discussion. I think that is probably the most important thing we can do right now. Certainly pray for the families that were victimized. The second thing is to sit down and have a calm, rational discussion on how we're going to deal with mental illness, and it's an epidemic in this nation.
When we hear from the gun control advocates who want to see stricter laws, they often point to statistics in our country versus other countries, and they say, look, we have an issue not just with gun deaths but with sort of mass killing deaths, and there's something that is setting us apart from other nations. Now, they've often viewed as the proliferation and the availability of guns. What you're saying is we're failing on the mental health side in the way that many other countries are. Obviously, other countries are not failing in the same way, right?
Well, I don't necessarily agree with that premise. I think you'll see that, and certainly in many of the Middle Eastern countries, you're seeing bombings, you see honor killings, you see a whole host of things that, you know, some would say are cultural. I would say maybe go beyond, well beyond cultural issues. So there's no question that this is a very difficult topic to broach, but it has to be discussed. I think that right now the issue and the epidemic of mental illness, for a lot of reasons, the economy is challenging. You know, the families are stressed. There's a lot of things that, you know, violence is prevalent on TV and desensitizing a lot of our young people. But more to the point, mental illness and mental health professionals should be addressing this particular epidemic in the country.
Congress does not have very high approval ratings right now, and you wouldn't be running for Congress if you were satisfied with everything you're seeing. So if you were a member of Congress and you wanted to help the mental health community, what is Congress not doing that could be done that would make changes?
I think, quite frankly, the discussion I just talked about, I think that Congress should be pulling the mental health professionals in from all over the country, the best of the best, to sit down and talk and discuss with them, to get advice from them on what the approach should be to deal with this terrible scourge, this epidemic that's facing all our communities.
What about background checks? Would you make any changes when it comes to background checks and firearms?
Well, I think background checks are important, certainly. In mental illness screenings are very important, and I know they're trying to do that now. But again, I think the first step is to start that dialogue with mental health professionals to deal with this root cause of violence that is occurring in so many communities, unfortunately, in the country.
My guest is Mark Cassini, the Gatestown supervisor and the Republican candidate for Congress in the 25th District, hoping to unseat Congresswoman Louise Slaughter. If you want to join the conversation this hour, you can do it toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or right here in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Before we go any further, Mark Cassini disagrees on a lot of policy positions with Louise Slaughter, but I also know that you feel very warmly about her family, and she's gone through a loss recently.
Absolutely. I wanted to offer my prayers and condolences to the Slaughter family and to Congresswoman Slaughter. By all accounts, her husband, Bob Slaughter, was a wonderful, wonderful man, and they were so very blessed to have been married for 57 years. That's just a great, great accomplishment. And so to the Slaughter family from the Assini family. We share with you your pain, and we offer our prayers.
Now, she has been a formidable political foe for decades now, and she ran a race in 2012 that a lot of people thought would be closer. She ended up winning handily over Monroe County Executive Maggie Brooks, and so you've got to be a student of history if you want to win a race like this as an underdog. What did Ms. Brooks do wrong?
I'm not so sure that Ms. Brooks did anything wrong. I think what we were dealing with was a presidential turnout that was extraordinary. Certainly, and the numbers are the numbers. In the city of Rochester, Mrs. Brooks lost handily. In fact, the margin of her defeat was mainly from the city of Rochester. More to the point, in midterm elections are such different animals than presidential elections. The turnout for the party in power tends to be suppressed. In fact, I have here from Democracy Corps, in fact, a letter from James Carville, who I admire greatly. I've read a number of his books. He's a brilliant guy. Either you think he's a genius or an evil genius. I happen to think he's a genius. I really like James Carville. But he's pointing out that right now Democrat voters are at a 7-point disadvantage, and that's nationally, and certainly that'll equate to this community. Second, the suburban voters will turn out in greater numbers. And again, that's not to offend city voters. I certainly would appreciate your vote. But the reality is that we will see a much different turnout. There will be a much different set of numbers in this midterm election than there was in the presidential election. And I think that midterm turnout will make the difference. If we get the typical midterm turnout, I think we have a chance of winning this race. I truly do. And I will say that there is nothing more powerful than an idea whose time has come, and I think it is time for change in the district.
Now, we had a chance to talk to Congressman Tom Reed last week. Hope to have his opponent, Martha Robertson, on the show soon. Congressman Maffei, Congressman Chris Collins. We've got yourself. We've got a lot of people who will be joining us on this program. And we wanted to start in the spring. I didn't want to wait until September, October, first week of November, Mark. But when you are talking to voters, are they locked in yet? And what are they talking to you about?
Most voters, to be quite honest, are not locked in at this point.
Yeah.
I've been out door to door. I've done well over 1,000 homes on the east side of Monroe County already. And in talking to them, they're looking forward to the election, but they're not deep into the details. One of the things that is on everybody's mind, though, is the economy. By far, the economy is the biggest issue in this district, without a doubt. And I think nationally, and again, referring back to James Carville, he points to that as the number one issue in the upcoming midterm elections, and it certainly is in this area.
Well, wasn't it Carville who said it's the economy, stupid? Was it him? That was probably his line originally.
Yes.
About 20-plus years ago. Mark Assini is in here challenging Louise Slaughter for her seat in Congress. And, okay, economy is the number one issue for voters. But today, the Dow is at another new high. And a lot of people are looking at Wall Street. They're looking at the Dow. They're wondering if the Dow is doing so well. We keep hearing that there are trillions of dollars sitting on the sidelines and CEOs don't want to make hires yet and they're concerned about uncertainty over taxation and other issues. But a lot of people are wondering, when will the time come for more widespread hiring, especially if these companies are doing so well? What do you think?
That's a good question. But let me go back to some facts if I could, Evan. First of all, there's no question we are struggling. GDP only grew in the last quarter at 0.1%. That is absolutely abysmal. That is devastating. The median income for families is down over 4% since 2008. It's gone from about an average of $54,000 per household to $51,000. Poverty is at an all-time high. It's over 46 million. And workforce participation, the workforce participation rate is at its lowest, 62.8% in 35 years. And more to the people who are unemployed right now, 47% of them, based on a recent survey, 47% of the people looking for work have given up hope. There's no doubt that the economy is struggling. We've seen Kodak Alaris employing about 5,000 people from a Kodak's height of 64,000. We've seen Bausch & Lomb, a great manufacturer in this area, purchased by a Canadian company and just a shell of what it was. We're dealing with a very, very difficult economy, and that's on everyone's mind. And the question that you asked specifically is, when is the investment going to come from those corporations that are reaping the benefits and the profits that are occurring right now. And the answer is they are definitely waiting to see how the midterm elections turn out. And I think after the midterms, you will start seeing some investment. But it depends on how the midterms turn out. I don't mean to be ominous, but I think that's very true.
No, I think that if you accept the premise that based on looking at the markets, the Dows, the companies at the top end at least are doing well, and the CEOs are concerned about, from the top down, concerned about when to start hiring and uncertainty, you could also argue, couldn't you, that in 2008 we heard the same warnings that if a Democrat was elected that Wall Street would be too concerned about taxation and they wouldn't cooperate. 2012, we heard the same thing, and yet the market goes up, the market goes up, the market goes up, and we still don't see widespread hiring. At what point will those CEOs say, hey, things are actually okay?
Well, the gap is getting greater and greater between the ones who are doing very well
yes.
and the middle class. The middle class is evaporating, and I think a lot of it has to do with the policies that we're dealing with. That's really the truth of the matter. And, you know, in the Rochester area, many people don't know this, but I think it's important to point it out. Rochester specifically is the fifth poorest city in the United States, according to the Community Foundation. We are struggling in a very big way. So I think the next logical question is, well, what should we be doing? And I think if you turn to, and I'm a businessman, if you turn to, you know, the business leaders, they're telling you the number one issue that we're dealing with, and the Alliance for American Manufacturing, and we are still a manufacturing community, is the trade deficit with China and the corporate tax rate. Right now, we're dealing with this enormous animal, $300 billion plus trade deficit with China, who is manipulating currency, who, quite frankly, is stealing intellectual properties, estimated according to the IP Commission that looks at these things, over $300 billion worth of stolen intellectual properties. They account for, since 2000, almost 3 million jobs lost to China. We're not dealing with a country that is dealing on a fair level with us. And they're asking for some enforcement on some of the trade agreements, on the manipulation of currency, on the monetary manipulation that's going on. The Alliance for Manufacturing is saying, Mr. President, and this is a letter right to the President, please address the trade issues and specifically China. So we have to deal with the trade deficit and we have to deal with China. We also have to cut the corporate tax rate. We're the number one in the world. And quite frankly, it's very difficult to compete globally with other companies when your tax rate is putting you at a disadvantage. There's a number of other issues. I don't want to go too far down on this, energy independence and so on and so forth. But that certainly is what the Alliance for Manufacturing is saying, and we are a manufacturing community still.
Sure, and there's a lot to chew on there. Let's kind of hit it one by one. First of all, on China, in the last election, John Huntsman was a candidate early on, didn't last very long in the presidential side, but he was former ambassador to China, and he talked about the importance of sort of splitting the difference with not becoming a doormat for China, but also not wanting to create a trade war with unnecessary bombast. And what you're talking about is getting tough in a way
absolutely
that says we've got to have more of a backbone, but are there potential consequences and deleterious effects to what you're talking about?
Well, first of all, a trade war assumes that you're fighting back. We're getting crushed. We're absolutely getting crushed. And quite frankly, again, in a trade war, you know who always loses? The seller. China has much more to lose than the United States in this issue. They people worry about the fact that they fund our debt, which is at $17.5 trillion, but it's only a piece of our debt. It's under 10%. So I think that we should start sitting down with China, explain to them, look, we're going to start leveling tariffs on you unless you start working with us on a fair playing field. We cannot take the $300 billion plus deficit. You're talking hundreds and thousands of jobs that have been lost, millions, according to some of the studies since 2000. This is a must. We have to start addressing this issue, or we're going to continue to see jobs bleed out of the United States and go overseas. So we have to get tough with China, no question about it. And I would say, with all respect, Mr. Huntsman, that in a war, that means you're fighting back. We're not fighting back at this point.
You also mentioned the corporate tax rate, top in the world, but you also... We have such a complex tax code.
Yeah, the effective rate and all the other issues that go along
with it. It's just remarkable. And it is so, it's almost impenetrable for the average person. The tax code is so complex. It keeps a lot of people in that line of work, and I understand. I'm not denigrating the line of work, Mr. Hassini, but at the same time, if we simplified things and simply took away a lot of the corporate tax loopholes that have been written about so often, is it possible that right now corporations are actually getting a pretty good deal? That there are so many at the top are paying a much lower rate than the books say they should be.
Well, it's actually interesting. We did the study. If I pull the study out, there's a study that was done, and they actually took a look at that very issue, and they compared to other countries. Let me pull the study out as I'm.
Yeah, go ahead.
Looking here, and we did not do very well. It was KPMG that did the study and tried to condense it down to the form you're talking about. And folks can go look online. It's a corporate tax rates table that was put together by KPMG, and we just don't fare well, no matter how you stack it up. So the answer is we're not competitive across the globe when it comes to corporate tax rates.
Should we simplify the tax code in general, though?
Absolutely, of course. Of course. That's the challenge, is simplifying the tax code. There's so many industries that are based off of a complex tax code and all the loopholes that go with it that is a challenge. But I absolutely would be for simplifying the tax code, no question about that.
Let's take our first call. Keith, thanks for calling Connections. Go ahead, Keith.
Hey, interesting show, Evan. A couple of things. The tax rate is one thing, but with companies, you may have a tax rate that's high, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're actually going to end up by paying that because they have all the deductions. For example, oil companies can deduct losses from overseas that they incur on their federal taxes.
Right.
Now, I own a corporation. I'm a small company. At best, three people. All right? I haven't made a dime profit in 37 years because I get any money left over at the end of the year. I just take it as income. But the biggest expense, and you could change the whole paradigm of business in this country, is if you have a single-payer healthcare system. When you have a company such as Starbucks that spends more on healthcare than they do on coffee, and the car companies spend more on healthcare than they do on steel, there's something wrong. Every other industrialized nation, their companies don't have to worry about the cost of health care because it's carried by the cost of every carried by every citizen within that country. And that's the way it should be. If you own a business, would you like to eliminate all your health care costs that you have to pay for your employees? Most businesses say yes.
Well, thanks for the call, Keith. Let's let Mark jump in on that.
Well, I think Keith's point's accurate that one of the largest expenses for business is healthcare costs. It certainly is. I'm a town supervisor in the town of Gates. I can tell you that's one of our largest expenses is healthcare costs. So he's accurate. That is one of the big constraints, cost constraints in this country for businesses and municipalities. Having said that, I don't have an issue looking at a single-payer system, looking at what Canada has done, just to see what they've done and how successful they've been in certain areas. I don't think a single-payer system will be right for this country. I think Hillary Clinton just spoke about this in March, where she said a one-size-fits-all system, a single-payer system, would not work here in the United States. And I agree with Mrs. Clinton on that one.
We're going to be focusing on single payer as an issue on this show coming up with the question of if states are interested. Vermont is actually moving toward a single payer system statewide in 2017. And we're going to talk to people in Vermont about why they chose to go that direction and some of the debate there. We're going to hear from doctors on both sides. I know several doctors who are literally leaving the business because they're tired of the paperwork and the bureaucracy. One doctor who's fed up would like to get out of the Affordable Care Act and go back to where the system was before. Another who supports the idea of insuring more people but wants single payer. So I think there's a lot of dissatisfaction regardless where we currently stand.
Is this called a segue?
Well,
into Affordable Care?
Well, we could probably spend the entire day on the Affordable Care Act.
Sure.
And I understand our callers would want to talk about that too. I know that you're not a fan in general, Mark, but let's start with this here. What parts of the Affordable Care Act, if any, would you keep?
Well, I like the idea of having eliminating the lifetime caps. I like the idea in the Affordable Care Act of the elimination of pre-existing conditions. I like the idea of allowing children to stay on family plans until, you know, the age 26. So those are things that are good. I like the healthcare exchange itself. I like the idea of insurance companies posting their rates so people can shop around and get a good idea of what the best bargains are. Some of the things there are a few things that are just devastating in the Affordable Care Act that absolutely have to change, and they have to change quickly. First of all, the Medicare and Medicare Advantage issues are enormous. MVP, our local carrier, has already indicated that the rate increases and the service cuts that you've seen if you're a Medicare Advantage subscriber, and there's 86,000 Medicare Advantage subscribers in the Rochester area, those increases and those cuts to services are directly attributable to the Affordable Care Act and the cuts that are occurring in the Affordable Care Act. So, you know, the cuts to Medicare have to end because we're going to hurt the very people we're trying to help. I mean, you're hurting one population, and the monies that are being saved in those cuts to Medicare and Medicare Advantage are being used for the subsidies to stabilize the rates for people to buy insurance on the exchanges. That's just not acceptable. You can't hurt one segment of the population to help another segment of the population. That's just not fair.
To be fair, let me read Congresswoman Slaughter's response to that. And if you're just joining us, my guest is Mark Cassini, the Gatestown supervisor who is running for Congress challenging Louise Slaughter this year. If you're on the phone waiting to talk, we will get you in just a second. On the issue that Mark just talked about, this comes from Congresswoman Slaughter. They put out sort of their own what they called myth versus fact sheet on Medicare Advantage and some of these cuts. She said, quote, some of the cuts could in fact happen, although the industry has cried wolf before and continues to thrive. But the key point is this. Over the past decade, enrollees in Medicare Advantage have received lots of extra benefits thanks to unjustified federal subsidies to the insurance companies. Now they will have to deal with somewhat less unless the insurers are willing to absorb the cuts while maintaining benefits. Enrollment in these private plans offered by companies like United Health and Humana has more than doubled since 2006, in part because of lower premiums and extra benefits like gym memberships that are not included in traditional fee-for-service Medicare. What made these perks possible was, in effect, a subsidy from taxpayers and other Medicare beneficiaries. The federal government paid the private plans, on average, 14% more in 2009 than it would cost to treat the same people in traditional Medicare. The insurers used this extra money to reduce enrollees' costs and add benefits, so the 2010 Affordable Care Act rightly required that these subsidies be reduced, although it stopped short of completely eliminating them. Mark?
Well, that's a long answer. But the truth is, truths tend to be simple, and the simple truth is that Senator Schumer, the senior senator from New York, somebody from the very same political party, has contradicted what was said by Congresswoman Slaughter. He's come out and said and stood for a hold on any cuts in 2015 for Medicare Advantage. In fact, he joined a group of bipartisan senators saying, we need to hold off on cuts to Medicare Advantage in 2015 so that we will not hurt the Medicare Advantage subscribers. He was very concerned about the cuts and specifically talked about the impact to the Medicare Advantage recipients. So he's on one side of this issue, and there were 62 Democrat House members that also signed a letter joining in and agreeing with Senator Schumer as well as several Republicans. And so the point, I guess, is you have the senior senator from New York, a Democrat, saying one thing, and you have the senior House member from New York saying another thing. They both can't be right. One of them is right, and one of them is wrong.
You're going with Senator Schumer in this.
I'm going with Senator Schumer on this, and I've talked to the insurance brokers and healthcare providers, and there's no question we have another issue that we're dealing with. So folks know, the folks going into Medicare through 2030 are going to grow. The number, the volume of people going to the system is going to grow and peak in 2030. If you're pulling money out of the system, I don't care if you're using it to help with subsidies for folks to buy insurance on the exchange, the bottom line is you're pulling money out of the system at a time when the volume is growing. Something's going to give.
Back to the phones. Jenna in Pittsford, thanks for calling Connections. Jenna, you're on with Mark Cassini.
I have 2 points, one about healthcare and one about manufacturing. So I guess I'll start with healthcare since that's where you left off. I think that for families in our area right now, it's not even about insurance as much as it's about the healthcare costs, which aren't reduced either by what you refer to as the Affordable Care Act or its impact, a lot of big companies, because of the Affordable Care Act, are now going to these self-insured plans. Our city of Rochester is one of them, and certainly made a big splash in the news media recently because of it. And those companies with those self-insured plans have the right, because of the big insurance lobby, to pick and choose what they cover. So whether they decide to cover transgender and not cover autism, et cetera, families are left sort of holding the bag. In my family, for instance, my son is not entirely covered with his autism. Our medications cost us out of pocket over $6,000 a year.
Oh, my goodness.
His ABA might be covered, but his cognitive behavioral therapy is not covered at all. That's $150 every 2 weeks. You can do the math on that. Our four-year-old needed dental surgery. And the doctor decided the best way to do that was Edstrong under general anesthesia. And the insurance company said, we don't cover that.
Oh,
so we're
goodness.
Left with over $12,000 in out-of-pocket expenses, cash, that we owe Strong. And that is overwhelming. I don't have that kind of money. I just don't. And so for us, it's not about health care. We have insurance, and Evan knows us. We have decent jobs. But we don't have the money to cover those gaps, and that's where we look to people like you or like Louise Slaughter or Maggie Brooks or Mayor Warren and say, help, what do we do? Where do we go?
Jenna, hold that thought. We're going to get to manufacturing in a second. You want to weigh in on that, Mark?
Yeah, Jenna, wow, that is difficult. I'm so sorry for you. And to talk about cost specifically, and I was going to get to that. I was talking, some of the things that are going to impact us immediately, and Medicare was one of them. But to the cost, just so the other listeners know, and I apologize, Jenna, the Medical Trends Report has come out. We have a bit of breaking news here. We've gotten some of the preliminary information on medical trends through our insurance broker, and they are in the double digits. So we're going to see sizable increases in the Rochester area this year under the Affordable Care Act. Specifically for you, one of the things that I'd like to see is the expansion of these exchanges to create a competitive environment. And when I say expansion, I mean across state lines. I think the free market solution is probably one of the best to bring costs down. Certainly, we should look at what happened in the Rochester area. We town supervisors got together and we put a couple of thousand insurance contracts in a pool. And we said, okay, local providers, we're going to bid this out. We're going to give you a spec. Lowest cost wins. Well, guess what happened? The prices plummeted. We got great bargains. We saved, in the town of Gates, we saved well over $1 million over 3 years on our insurance costs. Now, specifically to your care, those are services, especially, you're dealing with autism is such a challenging issue to deal with. Those should be covered. There's no question about it. I'm puzzled at why we do what we do sometimes with care, but absolutely those should be covered. So on the cost side, I think we need to drive cost down through the free market solutions, and we should look at the very issues that you're bringing up, Jenna, and that is not fair and equitable to you and to others that are dealing with that situation.
We did have a caller tell us, and Jenna, hold that thought 1 second. We did have a caller tell us that they think it's difficult for us to talk about health care with political candidates. You'd need almost a referee of a third party in the room. I take the point, and obviously Mr. Assini and Ms. Slaughter are going to disagree on some of these issues,
right.
And we will be doing our best in the future to essentially do that, to sort of vet some of the things you hear on this program. We'll circle back. We'll talk about how the system is structured and plays out. But I take the point, but I don't think I don't want to take away Mark Assini's opportunity to at least talk about what he would do differently when it comes to health care if he were in Congress. Jenna, your second point on manufacturing. Go ahead.
My second point on manufacturing was I don't want to lose sight of the fact that I was hearing you clearly talk about the trade deficit in China and things like that, but I don't want to lose sight of the fact that I think a lot of it's going to come from hope and from the small manufacturer who grows their business. And one local story that I know personally, a company who a guy lost his job. He had three daughters who were in high school. One was in middle school, two were in high school. He knew they were going to be approaching college, and he knew he had to figure something out. And so he had all these computers that were breaking down, and he figured, okay, well, how can I refurbish these parts? And he created a business that has since become part of Rochester's Top 100 for the last several years. Last year is the only year it hasn't made it, and the reason for that is because he bought Xerox's building in Webster and made that his new home, and that obviously changed his bottom line for a little bit. But I think he now has customers coming from Dubai, the Middle East, all over the world, because he is refurbishing electronics and parts for electronics that you can't get. So when somebody's computer breaks down in their business, a cheese plant in Wisconsin, for instance, and you've got to keep the temperature at a certain point, or you can't manufacture cheese in Wisconsin anymore, how do I get this part? You call this guy in Webster. There's hope out there. You've got to create a business when there isn't one. And Rochester does that. We have that spirit, and we can't lose sight of that either. It's not just about China. It's about pulling your bootstraps up and figuring it out.
Well, thanks, Jenna, for the call. Mark, thoughts?
Oh, Jenna, that's a great point. One of our greatest strengths in this area is our ingenuity, and we have some brilliant, brilliant business people and some very ingenious entrepreneurs, and you've pointed that out, Jenna, and you're absolutely right.
We're way late for a break. We're going to take the shortest break in radio. It's about 30 seconds long. We're going to find out if Mark Cassini thinks there should be a minimum wage at all, and if he does, what it should be and how to figure that out. Should we index it to inflation or not? And get back to your phone calls right when we come back on Connections with Mark Cassini running for Congress here on member-supported public radio. Coming up in our second hour, the legacy of Maya Angelou. The poet has passed away, and we'll focus on what she leaves for future generations. And we'll meet so-called miracle families, parents with children who have extraordinary health needs, how they're overcoming challenges every day with the help of local doctors and the help of caregivers at home. It's all coming up, second hour on Connections with Evan Dawson. Told you it was the shortest break in radio. I'm Evan Dawson. This is Connections. And you're hearing Mark Cassini today running for Congress in the 25th District. You will hear candidates across the board come in to this program. And so you're going to hear his opponent, Louise Slaughter. She's been on this program before. She'll be on again. And we hope to have many more in the months to come, giving you a chance to hear their viewpoints before you have to decide who deserves your vote. Now, Mark, does this country, should there be a federal minimum wage?
No. I think that's something that should be left up to the state. And I'll tell you why. I think that when you look at the economy in the state, when you look at the needs of the businesses in a certain region, they'll differ, for instance, between Rochester and Buffalo. I mean, what would be a good wage in Rochester may not be in Buffalo. So when you start doing that at the federal level, I don't think it's a good idea. I think you should let the state determine what the best minimum wage should be. I agree with a minimum wage, but I think that should be left to the states. And the governor has already stated what he thinks the minimum wage should be. It just becomes very difficult to do it at the federal level, and it causes all kinds of complexities.
Do you view the minimum wage as being, should it be a living wage?
Should it be a living wage? Yes, it should be a living wage, but that, you know, it depends on what your definition of a living wage is. And again, it's interesting not to keep referencing back to James Carville, but one of the most important points they make in the campaign that's upcoming, one of the talking points for the candidates that are running under the Democrat flag from Democracy Corps is the minimum wage, that they have to go out. He had talked about them going out and making sure that they talk about minimum wage and a living wage and so on and so forth. So that's certainly part of the strategy. That's one of the reasons the president is bringing it out. We have a minimum wage in the state. The governor had taken a thoughtful approach to it. I do believe, you know, he's gotten it right, at least for the state of New York. And no, I don't believe that there should be a federal minimum wage.
Back to the phones. Bonnie in Rochester. Go ahead, Bonnie.
Yeah, hi. First of all, I'm glad to hear that you say that you're going to have someone from Vermont talk about single-payer health care. I assume that's in the near future. I get these issues that are fairly very important and somewhat complex. I think it's good to do cover the issue itself, not just when somebody's running for office or not just part of a broader agenda, because it's hard to get all the real facts. Some of the things that your current guest said are definitely things to challenge. So in addition, there are people here in New York, though, not to put anything against Vermont, because they're actually trying to get this now, so we'd want to know about that. But there, I just heard somebody from Albany who said this, Dr. Andy Coates, who's for Physicians for Single Payer. And another name I'll give to you is Bill McCoy, who's been very active in single payer for many years. Those two names are people you might want to have on your show because they've done a lot of the single payer things for years, and they're very, very good. The second thing I'd like to recommend, though, is that when you do have people that are running for office on, it's good to have each one of them so they have their full time. But I would also strongly suggest, and this probably would take two 1370 connection programs as we get further toward the election, is to have panels with all the candidates on the radio program and maybe even take the 2 hours, because it's also the competition of ideas being said at the same time that has validity in addition to just each person saying their own thing. I'm not against that, but I just say you need both in order to kind of get the most accurate and desirable ideas out. So thank you.
Thanks, Bonnie. I know Mark will welcome that, and we'll certainly seek to do that.
Well, Evan, if I could, I'd have 100 forums and debates. I think it'll be closer to one, but than it will be 100. But I would certainly love to do that.
You also mentioned unemployment, and certainly it's true in this country that there's the unemployment rate, but there's also sort of the chronically unemployed and those who have dropped out of the labor force, and calculating a number is difficult. When your opponent, when Ms. Slaughter was on this program back in January, it was at a time where there were questions on extending unemployment insurance. Would you have voted to extend unemployment insurance?
Yeah, and I probably would differ from my party on this. And the reason is that I do believe we are in economic crisis right now. I think we are in a very, very serious financial crunch. I think families are struggling like they have not struggled since the Depression. I'm not overemphasizing the struggles. I see it in my town. I see it with my neighbors. The question becomes, how long do you extend it and how do you deal with that extension? I don't want to make this a program that goes on ad infinitum. But absolutely, we are in economic crisis. And normally, I would say no if the economy were strong. But it is not. It is anything but strong. So I would support that.
We have a question from David online, who wants to know if Marcassini will be just as addicted as his party to Benghazi. I don't know what that means, but
I don't know.
I understand the point. I think what he's saying is we've heard a lot about Benghazi in the news, and certainly you see this congressional committee now. And do you think it should be a priority right now? Are you concerned about it, or are you sort of singularly focused on the economy?
Well, I don't want to make it a grand issue. I want to make sure that we investigate specifically what happened, how our a diplomat and our soldiers were killed. And I know there has been some recommendations on how to prevent something like this in the future. I'm not of the mind that somehow or another that this was an intentional act, that we abandoned our ambassador and our citizens. I just can't believe that would be the case. I don't believe that. So all I would say is that I would like to see exactly what it was that transpired. I don't think all the answers are there. And I think the families deserve to know how this happened. It's that simple.
When it comes to, you've talked a lot this hour about making sure that local governments, local municipalities have maybe a little more control. It sounds like you're a fan of federalism and giving states and municipalities a chance to sort of set their own agenda. And that's part of the question when it comes to education. Interestingly enough, Common Core started with governors and the business community. And one of the complaints about it was it sort of lacked educators. And so for a while, there was some degree of thought that the political right would favor Common Core, but now it sort of has devolved into this a bit of a mess right now where there isn't a whole lot of support from any part of the parties. I'm curious to know how you feel about it and how you feel about the federal role in education in general.
First of all, Common Core, and no disrespect to those that support it, it seems like we have a program du jour, whether it's No Child Left Behind that the president, and each of the presidents have had their program du jour raised to the top, and Common Core. I would say that the federal government should stay out of local education, to be quite frank. I think that let the local educators, the school districts, the regional school boards, the state deal with those issues. We're not dumb people. We know exactly what we need to do to be able to compete in a global economy. We don't need the federal government telling us how to get it done and what the standards should be. I think we are bright enough to figure it out at a local level and a state level. So, yeah, I don't see the federal government having a role in telling folks what the standards should and shouldn't be on Common Core.
Would you abolish the Department of Education?
No, I wouldn't abolish the Department of Education. No.
Okay. When it comes to higher education, we have a $1.1 trillion student loan debt crisis in this country, more than credit card. I think the credit card debt in this country is something like $670 billion. Loan debt is about $1.1 trillion. And you hear political leaders trying to come up with solutions to it. We have five different colleges and universities between Syracuse and Buffalo that are $60,000 a year or more annually. And that's gone up 150%, even adjusted for inflation, in the last 40 years. And part of the question is, should there be more federal subsidy for students? Or does federal subsidy cause institutions to raise their prices knowing that the money is going to be coming to them eventually and that essentially students and taxpayers get stuck with the bill? Where do you fall on what to do about loan debt?
Well, as far as more federal subsidies to schools, I'm not exactly sure that would solve the problem, to be honest with you. But I do not want to see our institutions. We have the greatest university systems in the world. I mean, people come from all over. We don't see people leaving the United States to go to India or to China to go to school. Very rarely. It's the other way around. They usually come here. So, but I'm not exactly sure federal subsidies would solve the problem. I think the problem is we have a number of schools that have to learn how to deal with tuition. And sometimes we focus on things that maybe – I don't want to be too critical here. How do I say this? We're focusing on some things that are not productive as far as education is concerned in the higher ed arena.
It's not sustainable, is it? The rising rate is not sustainable.
Well, I can't see how it would be sustainable. Look, the country is – you know, and I know there are people out there saying, no, we've got to do something. But the country is $17.5 trillion in debt. At some point, we're just not going to be able to sustain – further growth, and that would mean subsidies. I mean, our bridges here in New York State, which are mainly funded by the TIP, the Transportation Improvement Program, and partially funded by the state, our bridges are deficient. We have one third of the bridges in the area that are in bad shape. There's some that are just, you know, we had one in Gates that had to close down because the structural steel had eroded away, 75 years old. My point is that we have to start prioritizing things and what the most important things are. For certainly, public safety is a big issue. So when you're $17.5 trillion in debt and you start talking about federal subsidies to support something which is not running as efficient as it should, you have to take a step back and say, is that the right place to spend the money? Maybe we should be focusing on making sure our bridges aren't collapsing and those types of things. But
would you leave some of the social issues that we see come up on an annual or semi-annual basis, would you leave those to the states in general?
Yes.
Social issues, you're not interested in going to Congress and spending much time thinking about either medical marijuana, recreational marijuana, same-sex marriage, et cetera?
The states, that's a states' rights issue, and we should leave it to the states. There's some things that we'll deal with in Congress, in the House, but on those issues, but very few.
All right, I got a couple minutes left. You mentioned energy, and the president has talked about a sort of a all of the options on the table. Eventually, though, with finite resources, we do need to eventually bridge somewhere to something that's a little bit more sustainable for future generations. Give me a take of what you think on the future of energy in this country.
Well, I think that renewable energies is the future, but we're not there. We are many, many years away from renewable energy, and we need to bridge the gap between our needs currently and the interim needs over the next 15 or 20 years and getting to the point where renewable energy is available and cost-effective in the marketplace. It's not there yet. So I agree with the president when he talks about expansion of fracking. I think we should. I'm disappointed that the Keystone Pipeline was not supported. I think it should be. Those are things that would be transformational. Energy is a transformational issue in this country. It would give our manufacturers advantage. It would provide money. It would bring resources and taxes and money. It'd keep it right here in the United States. And quite frankly, it's a strategic issue because it's never good to be beholden for energy needs to countries that don't exactly like you.
Last quick question. We've heard Charles Krauthammer, George Will, others say that moving away from carbon too quickly could cripple the economy. We've heard others, a UN report, say that the impact could be absorbed with the rise of other industries. I know you said those industries are largely not scalable or ready yet, but do you think moving away from carbon too quickly could cripple our economy?
We're not ready for it. I mean, it's that simple. We are just not ready for it.
Mark Cassini has been here for the hour, and his opponent, Louise Slaughter, the longtime incumbent member of Congress, will join us as well. And Mark, I hope you'll come back, and because we essentially barely scratched the surface even in an hour. So I hope you'll come back.
It's already an hour?
It has been already about an hour. Thank you for being here.
Thank you very much, Evan. Appreciate it.
And answering some questions from our callers and listeners as well. Mark Cassini is the supervisor of the town of Gates and challenging Louise Slaughter in the 25th District. Here on Connections, we're trying to bring the candidates for a lot of prominent offices to you. Give you a chance to talk to them and hear their views on the issues at length and in depth. And to the extent that we can't get to everything, we'll be glad to have him back in the months to come before Election Day. Short break and a look at the legacy of Maya Angelou next on Connections.